Indiana suspends its Medicaid work requirement. The House formalizes the impeachment inquiry. Plus, NCAA players getting paid and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 1st, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Indiana Family and Social Services Administration, FSSA, temporarily suspended the work requirements for people on the Healthy Indiana Plan in response to a federal lawsuit filed last month. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports.
The lawsuit challenging HIP, Indiana's Medicaid expansion plan, threatens more than the requirement to report work or volunteer hours. The suit also challenges lockout penalties and premium payments included in the program. FSSA says they're suspending the requirements and will wait and see what happens with this suit and similar challenges in other states. The work requirements started this year. In January 2020, some Hoosiers on HIP could have had their benefits suspended if they didn't report hours. FSSA says members are still encouraged to log hours and receive work training and education assistance. An estimated 70,000 Hoosiers were expected to comply with the requirements. More than 400,000 people have health coverage through HIP.
Was this the pragmatic move from the state? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Lindsay Erdody, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly, state house reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting state house reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, while this lawsuit plays out, and it's not the only one, of course, around the country, was this just the right move for the state in the short term?
The right move for the state in the short and long term is to get rid of this requirement, period. I mean, it is absurd. And the reason it's absurd is that 80% of the people on Medicaid right now are in families where there is a working person, okay? You've got a huge number of people with disabilities or illness, more than a third with disabilities or illness. You have retirees in nursing homes. You have, almost 20% that are full-time students. I mean, the number of people that would be eligible and aren't working is so small that we're going to be hiring more people to administer this program than we are going to get to work.
Statistics for the whole Medicaid population, not the HIP population.
Well, that's true, but this is the first step of the camel's head under the tent. People on the Republican side, particularly on the right-wing Republican side, think that there ought to be a work requirement for all of it.
No one's talking about that.
Well, we'll see. But the most important thing, it seems to me, would be for the federal government and the state government to get together and say, okay, if we want to incentivize these people to work, we're not going to cost them their Medicaid coverage at the same time.
Right, which is why the state is introduced this program to build a bridge.
Right.
If they do have a success problem, Ann, and get a job that pays them too much money to be on Medicaid, these are good problems.
No,
these are pretty good problems.
They're
going to
get a job that pays them $10 an hour, and it's not going to have benefits, and it's not going to be a bridge to something else, and they're not going to be able to pay for it.
All right, look, so
it's going to cost them Medicaid coverage.
So you describe the entire Medicaid program: the elderly, age-blind, disabled population,
right,
pregnant mothers and kids. No one's talking about those people, the national conversation, including this work requirement, and no one's ever going to talk about them because no one's going to force pregnant women to go make sure.
What about those in the nursing homes? They're malingering.
Not them either. So, look, at the national level, the conversation is on your side. How do we get to a fully government-provided health care system? How do we make sure the only place you get your health insurance is through the government?
That's
right?
Medicare for all.
Your leading candidate is talking about Medicare for all.
There are two leading candidates that are talking about. There are two that are talking about that as
an
option.
And may wind up being the president one day.
But
if that is the case, I don't think it's the right wing that is driving this. I think a rational voter, a reasonable citizen would think, if the government is providing this benefit and you're capable of working or volunteering in your
benefit,
community,
it's an entitlement.
If you're capable of working or volunteering in your community, then maybe you ought to give a little bit back for that benefit you're being given.
And how much does it cost to set that structure up to police those people? And how many are you talking about as a percentage
I'm glad you asked that question. So the state's Medicaid program is under a managed care system. It's built into that fixed fee that is paid to the managed care companies in a benefit they have to manage and a program they have to administer and monitor.
Mm-hmm. And when this goes into effect, how much more is that going to cost us?
It's built into the program.
Oh, it's built into the program. They're gonna monitor it. They're not gonna ask for anything.
No, it'll be contracted, but it's gonna,
right. So it's gonna cost something
right,
to
sure,
do.
Of course
we
so.
Don't even know the percentage of people that are
in Indiana. We've had in the last 5 years. In the last 5 years, this program has gone from 400,000 people that were years ago, and it was the traditional Medicaid program you described.
To a million.
To 1.5 million.
Yeah.
And it's not going
right.
to get smaller.
And we still have,
and it's
we
including
still have a
more
growing
and more
number
people that can,
of children who have no coverage.
Right, and they should.
Under you.
And they should have coverage.
Lindsay, I want to ask this question. So this has been entirely done so far by the Holcomb administration in concert with the federal government. So the legislature really hasn't weighed in on these work requirements at all, though I suspect they probably support them. Now that there's this lawsuit involved, is that more incentive for them to just stay out of it entirely?
For state lawmakers to stay
yeah.
out of it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, probably, yeah. Why are you going to get entangled into something that's going to play out in the courts? I mean, we've already seen now, you've got two cases that are going to the appellate level, and our case is still lingering out there, and you've got Attorney General Curtis Hill who came out today saying, you know, let's just hold off on our case and let these other two play out. So I think everyone's just kind of trying to take a step back from this, in Indiana at least, and say, you know what, let's see how everything else goes.
And this is something that, this is not a short, I mean, these were set to take, well, the work requirements were already in effect. People were going to potentially start losing coverage
January 1.
But now that this has been suspended, at least temporarily, I mean, temporarily could be a long time,
right? It could be a long time. And I do want to point out that it's not just the work requirements that are part of that lawsuit.
That's true.
There are two parts of HIP that have been there since the very beginning, where you have premium payments and lockout periods if you don't, you know, follow the rules. So it kind of leaves those up in the air. I mean, as far as I can tell, there hasn't been a preliminary injunction request. Obviously, they would have easily been able to get an injunction on the work requirements, because that has happened. All the court rulings that we've seen have been against the programs. But right. those other ones, which are in state law, are still open. So I assume they just continue using those until court tells them not to.
Yeah, that could be honestly the more interesting, maybe even the more interesting outcome.
That's what drove the state to suspend the program.
Yeah. All right. Well, the U.S. House this week voted almost entirely along party lines to pass a resolution formalizing its impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
The vote was 232 to 196, with two Democrats joining every Republican in the House of Representatives against the impeachment procedure resolution. Independent Justin Amash, who left the GOP earlier this year, voted for it. That partisan split was true in Indiana, as Democrats Pete Visklosky and Andre Carson voted in favor, while the Hoosier State's seven Republicans voted against it. The resolution authorizes the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee to conduct open hearings and allows the president and his attorneys to cross-examine witnesses. It also directs the House committees leading the inquiry to report their findings to the House Judiciary Committee, which will decide whether to recommend moving forward with articles of impeachment.
Mike O'Brien, how much does it matter at this stage, where you're just formalizing the start, the sort of public start of this, how much does it matter that this vote was basically partisan?
I think it matters a lot because in particular because we're in the middle of a presidential election, or at least a Democratic primary.
And we're always in the middle of a presidential election nowadays.
Unfortunately, that is absolutely true. But there'd be a lot more credibility, I think, with the voters that ultimately decide elections, that sit in the middle and decide whether this is credible or not. And they have to put that in the context of Democrats who have been trying to impeach for some reason since January 20th of 2017, Inauguration Day. And it's been a nonstop effort. They finally get into the window of the 2020 presidential election, and they grab onto this, and now they're going to do it. And they didn't do the process in order. This vote is normally how this process begins, not how it after the hearings have taken place and the committees are looking at.
That's actually not the case. What you had, for example, in the Clinton impeachment is we had an independent prosecutor doing the investigative stages, which is exactly what these committees are doing, and doing them in private, not in public, which is exactly what these committees are doing. It's analogous to a grand jury. And then you have the public part of that, which is coming now. But the irony of this is it's not just the partisanship. You got Kevin McCarthy up there saying that what President Trump did, which was hold up money or hold up access to the White House in exchange for digging up some dirt on an opponent or a potential opponent in the 2020 election was just fine. Nothing wrong with that at all. They want to take the position of defending that kind of abuse of power. Good luck with that. because that's something that's easily capable of being understood by the voters. It's not the emoluments clause. It's not all the other things that President Trump has done since he's been inaugurated. But that is a very simple thing for people to understand. And you have extremely credible witnesses up there saying that they were in the room and they heard that. And they were worried enough about it that they went to their superiors up the chain of command to say, this is not right. And then they hide or attempt to hide the it's not a transcript, it's really the note-taking of the conversation, and put it away so nobody else can see it. It shows you they realize that this was an abuse of power. And if for the Republicans to stand up and say that that's absolutely okay, good luck on that platform.
This is going to play out in public now, starting really in what we heard from Speaker Pelosi is apparently starting in November. A lot of this testimony that Ann just sort of alluded to is really going to be playing out in front of cameras and the public. But at this initial stage, does it actually, I called it basically partisan, and I said that because two Democrats actually voted against it. Does that give more credence to people like Mike who say this is a partisan process and it's, you know, going to undercut Democrats?
I don't think anyone thinks it's not a partisan process. I mean, we're not kidding ourselves, right? I mean, as a citizen, I think people are more concerned the fact, I mean, gosh, we're spending a lot of time and effort on something that we know isn't going to go anywhere. Like,
the
maybe
voters are also really going to decide.
Exactly. Even
if you think, if you don't spend the time, it's like saying it's okay, and it isn't okay.
I don't think it just says it's okay. I think they can also work on other things like immigration policy and budgets and, you know, health care.
Though, to be fair, there was no evidence that any of that was actually getting done before an impeachment inquiry started.
True.
But I agree that even if it gets out of the House, and there's evidence to suggest it will, there's almost no way it's getting through the Senate. So how important is the public process of this going to play out? And let me ask this. How important will it be if and when that House vote comes up to actually impeach him? Will it matter if that's all the Democrats versus all the Republicans too?
I would fully expect that to be the same way as what we saw this week. And in terms of the public hearings, I mean, even though the hearings they're having now and the interviews they're doing now are in private, we're still reading stories and hearing news stories about it every single day. You know, people's opening statements are getting leaked to reporters and they're having press conferences. I mean, it's not like things are happening in secret and we're not aware of some of the things that are going on now. So how much does the public side of that end up changing? I'm not really sure it changes a whole lot.
So I think everyone's just going to kind of tune out eventually. Is this like the third level of hearings we're having about something, whether it be Mueller?
To me, the only difference is we'll get this testimony in front of cameras, which then is put into a campaign ad. That might literally be the only difference.
Well, I just think that the conduct is so egregious that action has to be taken. I agree with you politically. It might be better to wait for the election, but it's more than about politics. He is trying to undermine the democratic process. That's what he's trying to do. And that you can't, if you took an oath to uphold the Constitution, you should not and cannot ignore that.
Well, the NCAA Board of Governors this week voted to crack open the door to allowing college athletes to benefit from their own name, image, and likeness. The language approved by the NCAA says whatever policy is eventually in place should be in a manner, quote, consistent with the collegiate model. And the college athletics behemoth issued a few points in its news release about what that might entail, including, quote, make clear that compensation for athletics performance or participation is impermissible, reaffirm that student athletes are students first and not employees of the university, and protect the recruiting environment and prohibit inducements to select, remain at, or transfer to a specific institution. California put pressure on the NCAA to make a change recently when it passed legislation taking effect in a few years to allow college athletes to sign endorsement deals and hire agents. Nikki Kelly, could we really see college athletics change?
I think we're headed there. I've read this resolution. I don't really understand what it's saying. I don't think
anyone... That might be the point.
Like we're opening this door, but not this, and this. So I don't really understand how it's going to work in sort of specifics. I mean, are we talking about where athletes get a cut of, you know, the TV revenue when they're on TV? Is that what we're talking about? I can't figure out where it's going, but I do think we are starting to see that ball move forward.
For the NCAA, to even acknowledge sort of this issue as something that might need to change, is that maybe the biggest win at this point for folks who want to see this change?
I think it's the biggest news out of this. I mean, in terms of what they actually did this week, because to Nikki's point, there's not a lot of specifics in there, and nothing's really going to happen for years still before we, you know, get more specifics or get something in writing that says, okay, this is exactly what you can do and what you can't do. But I think from what I've seen, those people who have been pushing for this are still just kind of like, well, of course you did this. Of course this is what you came out and said. You kind of had to at this point because the tides have kind of turned.
So this was prompted, obviously, in large part by the California legislation that pushed this ball even further down the court than it had been before. And other legislatures are starting to explore this. Illinois prominently, Florida a little bit, maybe Missouri too. Indiana, of course, is home to the NCAA. How much will lawmakers take that into consideration when they look at potentially doing something?
You can see the headquarters from the State House,
so
it makes it a little awkward. But you know, the NCAA rightly has a lot of sway here, and there should be a standard if they're going to go down this, if they're going to go down the track here. I don't think this should fit in here. Is that three?
Jump over the hurdle.
You know, I liken this a little bit to the conversation over sports betting. In that there was an acknowledgement. I think the reason that wasn't necessarily controversial is because there was a recognition that this is happening. And if you want the secret high school shoe contract to the next, you know, blue chip recruit to stop, you know, behind the scene, you know, that nobody ever hears about until there's a huge scandal and it blows up system wide, then maybe you need to start recognizing that there is a place to land on this, even if it's not pay them to play, but pay them to get the video game revenue or pay them to get, you know, a cut of their face on the front of the, you know, video game is fine.
There was also a response from at least one Republican U.S. Senator, Richard Burr of North Carolina, who said, well, if we're going to allow players to benefit from their own name, image, and likeness, then we should tax their athletic scholarships. Is there going to be, if... I don't think he's alone in thinking that, at least among some. So if this does go in the way that a lot of people would like it to go, is there going to be blowback from that, too?
You know, you're going to tax the income they're going to make off this, it seems
to
me. That ought to be enough. There was a very good op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday, I think, which talked about using the Bayh-Dole bill, which was a windfall to the universities about patents and research, and taking the money and basically giving a third of whatever the athlete raises by doing whatever the athlete's doing, endorsing shoes, tennis rackets, whatever. A third goes to the athlete, a third goes to the athletic program, and a third goes to the university, so that everybody has an interest in it because both the athletic program and the university have given them the platform to get that money. And that's worked tremendously successfully, the Bayh-Dole bill, for the universities over the years. I mean, it's been a windfall for them. And this could be, as well, at the same time, helping the athletes who are generating the revenue that you know, make these athletic programs successful. So I think the approach has got to be through the NCAA. They have got to sit down and say, this is the rule, because it has to apply to all 50 states, yeah, or it doesn't work.
Well, otherwise it undermines, like, the part of the resolution is you can't, like, pay someone to incentivize them to change a school if
right.
they still got eligibility
right.
left
right.
or something,
right.
and that would create a nightmare.
Yeah, because if only California schools have to, you know, pay
right.
athletes.
Yeah,
they'd be
lined up.
I think, right. one, if the NCAA, if there's a way for the NCAA to make money off of this, they'll find it. And two, I just want there to be another college football video game again. So now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should college athletes be allowed to profit off their name, image, and likeness? A yes or B no. Last week's question: will Curtis Hill be the Republican nominee for Attorney General in 2020? 21% say yes, 79% say no. That changed from the last time we asked that question, from 71 to 29. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, an Indiana nonprofit group is suing the Election Commission and Secretary of State Connie Lawson over voting machines that lack a paper trail.
The group Indiana Vote by Mail filed the suit in federal court. It describes itself as a nonpartisan organization committed to passing legislation that will make Indiana elections fair and accessible. The complaint accuses Indiana of a lack of urgency in updating its electronic voting machines to include voter-verifiable paper trails, which many election security experts recommend. The General Assembly allocated $10 million for that effort this year, which will only upgrade 10% of the machines that need them statewide. A majority of Indiana counties use the electronic voting machines that lack the paper trails. Secretary of State Connie Lawson projects the state will fully upgrade the machines by 2030.
PS4. Lindsay O'Doty, is this a lawsuit the way to prompt this change?
It could be. I mean, I guess we'll see what happens in the lawsuit, right? What I thought was interesting is that there's actually a case in Atlanta where a federal judge did decertify the machines that didn't have the paper trail. Doesn't mean that will happen in this case, but at least having the case has gotten us talking about it, and I think that's got to be part of the strategy, too.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this issue now for a little while. Connie Lawson said that she went to lawmakers, said, I need more money. They said, get real, which I believe was the literal quote.
A judge could tell them to get real.
Yeah, that could really change the conversation, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would have to be a judicial mandate of some kind because, you know, it's not like we have one system. We have 92 different counties with 92 different election boards. They are all paying for these, you know, with their own funds. So I'm not really sure how a statewide lawsuit would work with like that, other than just requiring the state to pony up.
Well, I mean, to Lindsay's point, the judge could decertify the machines, leaving them without any machines. And, well, if you have to go shopping for new ones, but...
You know, we have a swine barn with one-time expenditures of $40 million. We could do this in a heartbeat. We could do this in a heartbeat. And we need to. We have the technology to guarantee that our system is safe and we're not using it. We're going to implement it over 10 years. It's unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable. I hope a judge does step in and say, get real. The swine barn can wait. Put the machines in there that guarantee that those ballots are sacred.
It's unlikely that a judge will rule before the end of the 2020 session. But does the fact that there's a lawsuit hanging over their heads of sort, does that prompt lawmakers to go, all right, let's find some dollars here?
Yeah, well, yeah. But, well, look, the judge comes back and says, no, you've got to do it. You're not telling 92 county commissioners that they've got to go buy it when they don't have the money.
Right.
I mean, Connie Lawson did ask for a lot more money than the legislature gave her. There's been enough attention around it, and this lawsuit could motivate that in the session, because if they decertify those machines, then in the middle of an election year, we've got a real problem.
Yeah. Well, the
U.S.
House voted overwhelmingly this week to formally recognize the Armenian Genocide, though nearly half of the small number of no votes came from Indiana.
The resolution marks the first time either chamber of Congress has recognized the 1915 slaughter of Armenians by Ottoman Turks. That vote was 405-11, with four of those no votes coming from Hoosiers: Jim Baird, Susan Brooks, Larry Bouchon, and Greg Pence. Importantville's Adam Wren reported that the reason is Indiana Republican donor Erzal Ozdemir, who is from Turkey, lobbied them hard. Ozdemir is the owner of Keystone Group, a development and construction company, and Indy 11, the soccer team that just got approval from the General Assembly to move forward with a new stadium that could be financed in part by tax dollars. Ozdemir has donated thousands of dollars to those four members of Congress.
And Eleni, is this one that, I mean, this is a resolution, so its force and effect is questionable.
Yeah, but World War I's over.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that.
But is this one that looks bad more than it actually is bad?
I don't actually think so. I mean, the Turks, or the Ottomans then, killed 1.5 million Armenian Turks, okay? They killed them in a genocide. Now, President Trump has abandoned the Kurds at the border of Turkey, and we're seeing incursions in that, and I am deathly afraid we're going to have another genocide of the Kurds. So I think this resolution is timely from that point of view. I think we needed to step up and say to Erdogan, you are not going to have another genocide on our watch. And these people here who are elected officials from Indiana said it's more important to get contributions from somebody than it is to stand up on principle. So I think it's worse than looking bad. I think it could potentially send a signal that, you know, as long as you're Erdogan, you can do whatever the heck you want.
This was a resolution condemning a genocide, recognizing and condemning a genocide. And Greg Pence said the reason he voted against it was that he was backing up President Trump. If you put those two things together, is that a good message to send?
Well, I'd rather focus on what Jim Baird said, which who's my congressman.
Okay.
And I'm not. I don't know this issue and what's happening there, and tactically or strategically what the right message to send is. But Jim Baird said, you know, we have a lot going on there, but this maybe just wasn't the time to go try to reconcile this 100-year-old situation.
But that's exactly why you do it now.
I understand your point. I'm not saying it's not valid, and there were. I tend to agree with it since, you know,
405 people said
405
yes.
Other people said it. So I'm with you, Ann. How about that?
I like that.
Ozdemir is not just a player at the congressional level. He's obviously had a lot of stuff going on at the State House over the last few years. Does this factor into that at all?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. He's going to keep being a player in politics, regardless of how this ends up playing out. I mean, because I think you have to think about how much of the general public is really paying attention to this, or is that on their minds? Yeah. Not too much.
All right, well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.